From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Richmond, California.
San Jose.
San Jose.
Union City.
Eastside. Jackson.
I'm from the Campbell area.
Hayward.
Coming up, a Stanford fellow invents a tool to empower journalists in his native Nigeria.
If I'm able to expose these guys and write about them, then I will die a happy man.
Then we hear a radical idea about growing your own clothing?
14% unemployment rate. Well, we're importing wool from China and we're throwing it away in our own community. Why don't we have a friggin' mill, you know, where people could be employed?
And a local teen rethinks what she wears.
I saw hundreds of workers crowded around sewing machines and work tables. The sound of whooshing looms and the chemical smell of dye filled the air.
Conscious consumption on today's Cross Currents. Last week, activists joined Richmond Mayor Gail McLaughlin outside the Chevron annual shareholders meeting in San Ramon. They were protesting what they say is the negative effect the company's having on local Richmond communities, like pollution and the 2012 pipeline blast, and worldwide in countries in which it operates. Globally, activists and journalists are holding big oil accountable. In some countries, like Nigeria, they're up against not only the oil companies, but also the governments. Musikilo Mojeed is a Nigerian investigative journalist who's been reporting on his country's oil sector for over a decade, risking his safety to uncover massive corruption at the highest levels of government. He's now at Stanford University on a one-year fellowship where he's learning how to create an online database that'll allow journalists in Nigeria to access government files more freely. Mojeed came by our KALW studios where he first told me about the dangers of being an investigative journalist in Nigeria.
In 2011, when we did a reporting about the massive corruption in our oil industry, oil and gas industry. And at a point, we were almost killed. You know, we find people we believe were agents of government, of the officials in our oil and gas industry, oil and gas ministry and all of that, trailing us. And we had to go underground for a while. After a while, the police started chasing us too. They wanted us to come explain why we did this story.
Because you were exposing some high top officials, weren't you?
Yeah. Mm. So now we vacated the office for a while. We avoided our office for a while, my team and I. And then they wrote asking me to report to the police headquarters in Nigeria's capital. In fact, a police commissioner was put in charge of the case. And a police commissioner in Nigeria is a very top rank in the Nigerian police. And I didn't show up because I was warned by insiders in the police that if I show up, I will be detained. So my newspaper decided I shouldn't show up, that our managing editor was going to show up. When she did show up, she was detained.
So that was going to happen to you.
That was going to happen to me. But she was released afterward at the end of the day. But if I had shown up, it would have been different. So I had to...
So you know, investigative journalism, you know, exposing people in the oil industry, in the petroleum industry. Yeah. You've won awards for this work. But also, you know, it seems from what you're saying, you were at times fearful for your life after, you know, all these people are chasing you and trying to lure you to the police station. What makes you take that risk? What is it about this that you're willing to risk your life to do it?
When you look at the situation of my country, especially, I've told you that Nigeria is the sixth largest producer of oil in the world. And this is a country that has made perhaps more than $500 million, far more than, since the 70s. But today, Nigeria is one of the poorest countries in the world. You know, this is a country where just a very irritating poll by The Economist said, this year, Nigeria is the worst place for a child to be born. You know? And this is a country where people are really poor in the midst of plenty. And why is that the case? Because a lot of the resources of our country is stolen by our leaders. And I just felt, you know, my sense of social justice that this is wrong. Somebody must do this job. We must, whether they listen or they don't listen, we must keep writing about it. I feel this, that is the only contribution I can make to my country and the only legacy I can leave. If I'm able to expose these guys and write about them, then I will die a happy man.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm speaking with Musikilo Mojeed, a Nigerian investigative journalist and Stanford fellow. So let's talk about your work. Much of your reporting has been uncovering official corruption, especially in the oil sector, as you mentioned, for which you won the award, the Forum for African Investigative Reporters Editors Courage Award. So can you let me know what kind of things did you uncover for that reporting?
The presidential election was coming, and then we got a tip that the government, through the minister, that the president, through the minister, was getting bribed from the guys who were importing gasoline for us. So at that time, they were releasing licenses, papers for people to export or import product into Nigeria. So now they set up a scheme, a very fraudulent scheme. As you go pick up your paper, your license to import, you are expected to pay a certain amount of bribe to officials, which they said the president wanted for his election, for his campaign. So what we did, once we got that tip, what we did was that we also formed like a sham company. Not that we registered the company, but we came up with the name of a company. They were so reckless that they got a front man who takes the bribe and then delivers to the officials of government. So all you need to do is to call him and say, look, I'm from so-and-so company. My company has
the made-up company.
License.
You made it up.
Yeah, so we made up a company and we set up a team and we called him. We called the front man to say, our company has been given license to import 50,000 liters. How much are we supposed to pay? And he said we were supposed to pay dollars per barrel, per gallon or something. So which came to about maybe more than $50,000 or something. So we were recording him. We were talking to him on phone, and then we met him. And we recorded all of that. And we realized that everybody who got the allocation paid the same bribe, paid the same amount of bribe. So by the time we published that, with all the audio, with all the video, then it opened a floodgate of information for us. Then we got information about how these guys were taking oil blocks and awarding to themselves, violating Nigeria's law, how they were setting up companies, how they were even allocating contracts, how the minister allocated contracts she gave a license to somebody to import Nigeria's crude, somebody who had never done it before in violation of Nigeria's law. You understand? Somebody who had no experience became the biggest lifter of Nigerian crude. So we uncover quite a lot of stuff, very mind-boggling corruption in our oil and gas industry.
So what are you learning? What did you learn on the Stanford Fellowship that will help you when you go back home?
I realized over time that a lot of documents about the operation about Nigeria are available, even online. But Nigerian reporters don't even know how to source them. So what I'm doing, like a one-stop shop, creating an online platform where a lot of links, you know, putting Nigerian reporters in touch, you know, connecting them with the kind of resources with the kind of document they need to report Nigeria authoritatively, the kind of document, the kind of resource they need to hold Nigeria, the Nigerian government, individuals and even corporations accountable.
Musikilo Mojeed is a night journalism fellow at Stanford University. He's creating an online database to make it easier for journalists in his home country of Nigeria to access government files. How do you feel about oil companies? What are their responsibilities towards the communities they're based in? Tell us on our Facebook page, KALW, or on Twitter, at KALW. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Journalists can play a big role in finding out what goes on inside seemingly impenetrable sectors like big oil, big finance, and big clothing makers. The chemicals, fibers, dyes, and manufacturing, most likely they come from somewhere far away and it might not be a safe place, as shown by the recent tragedy at a Bangladeshi factory. Well, one Bay Area woman decided to make sure she knew exactly where her clothing came from. She set out to live a year wearing clothes made completely within 150 miles of her home. In this story from our archives, KALW's Ali Budner brings us her story as today's radical idea.
So this is my coffee berry sweater, which is hand-spun wool from the Chileno Valley and also the Redwood Valley in Mendocino. My name is Rebecca Burgess, and I am a natural dyer and the author of a book called Harvesting Color.
Burgess is also the creator of a project called Fibershed. It's sort of like the concept of a watershed or a food shed. According to Burgess, it's an awareness of where one's clothing comes from. So, for 1 year, Burgess has pledged to wear clothes made from materials and labor, all sourced from within 150 miles of her home in Marin County. She's assembled a team to help her accomplish a pretty radical goal.
We are going to be going from seed to skin.
And what does that mean exactly? Well, now 8 months into her Fibershed wardrobe challenge, Burgess's home has transformed into what could be a museum exhibit for natural dyes and fibers. There are baskets and wood bowls dappling her living room, filled with balls of hand-spun and hand-dyed yarns, all slightly different shades of rich earth tones. The labels read like poems: sky blue, indigo, winter fermentation, gray-brown, staghorn sumac, iron mordant, fall. And for each article of clothing Burgess wears, she knows where the animals were raised or where the cotton was grown, what plants were used to give it color, and who designed, knit, wove, and sewed it.
So my socks are made from Windrush Farms. And then my skirt is a color-grown organic cotton from Sally Fox's farm in the Cape Hay Valley.
Burgess now has about 18 garments in her personal Fibershed wardrobe. And yes, that does include the socks and the underwear. So right now, you might be thinking what many of Burgess's critics say when they first hear about her Fibershed wardrobe.
Like, yeah, no one else can do it, just you, and But then I remind them that it was only, 100 years ago, maybe even 200 years ago. And to this day, in many places in Asia and some places in Central Asia and even parts of Europe, people are living in fiber sheds.
It wasn't just homegrown aesthetics or a nostalgia for the simple life that led Burgess to take on this project. Burgess saw two pieces of a puzzle that needed connecting: a wealth of local resources and a lack of jobs in her community.
Well, we're importing wool from China and we're throwing it away in our own community. Why don't we have a friggin' mill, where people could be employed?
Once she started looking, she realized,
there's tons of fiber. Like, there's so much fiber, I won't even explore it all. In this year, we have a ton of sheep raised for meat, and they're getting sheared, but very little of their wool is getting dealt with or manipulated. And the number was 22,000 pounds is discarded in my county annually.
And beyond the raw materials, there's the dyeing process that takes place almost exclusively overseas. So Burgess traveled to Southeast Asia to see how denim, for example, is dyed to make our blue jeans blue.
285 million of our jeans in the United States are produced annually. That number is an annual figure. In the tributaries of the Pearl River in China.
In her research, Burgess says she's found that synthetic chemical dyes are one of the top polluters of freshwater resources on our planet.
And I saw a lot of it firsthand. I didn't see it all. I mean, there's so much to expose yourself to. And simultaneously, I was exposed to living, breathing fiber shed models. You know, I'd go to a remote village on the border of Thailand and Vietnam. There were women growing indigo, growing cotton, processing all of their own fibers, spinning them, carding, weaving, and dyeing them, and then wearing those clothes. And all of that was happening in a 20-mile radius of their, you know, teak hut that they were living in.
And this is the kind of model Burgess wants to replicate here.
There's 2,000 synthetic chemicals that are listed. Synthetic meaning these are not naturally occurring substances. Those that are associated with finishing a garment. So formaldehyde and flame retardants are kind of the most famous and infamous, and there are studies on those. What goes in the body is such an awareness we carry, but what on the body, what is worn on it, what is absorbed by it, is somehow missing in action, we'll say. The research is not available, the awareness isn't there, the dots have not connected in our brains yet.
Burgess intends to create an alternative to the more harmful synthetic blues that you commonly find in blue jeans. She's starting her own one-acre indigo plant farm this year, and it fits into her bigger vision of building a sustainable clothing system that will last beyond the year of her experiment. But to do that, she'll have to build a mill, because there are actually zero cotton mills in this area, and just one for wool.
So in response to that, it was like, well, if it has to happen, it has to happen. And I'll do whatever I can to help make that happen.
Sounds radical, yes. But at one point, maybe so did the idea of farm to fork. So why not seed to skin? At least Burgess is trying it out where radical ideas like these tend to take root. For Cross Currents, I'm Allie Budner.
How do you consume consciously? We want to hear your ideas. Leave them on our feedback line. It's 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106, and you may hear them on the air. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. There's been a lot of talk about what young people call fast fashion, mass-produced cheap clothing, in the wake of the recent factory collapse in Bangladesh. Besides major brands reconsidering their production process, some consumers are reevaluating the low cost of high fashion. Youth Radio's Bianca Brooks is coming to terms with her love of clothes and sends us her thoughts.
I've always had a deep love for fashion. I celebrate Fashion Week like it's a holiday. But earlier this year, I realized the true cost of these clothes when I met a group of women I'd been stealing from my whole life. As part of an exchange program, I traveled 8,000 miles from Oakland, California to Dhaka, Bangladesh. On a tour of Dhaka, I visited a factory that was making clothes for some of my favorite brands. I saw hundreds of workers crowded around sewing machines and work tables. The sound of whooshing looms and the chemical smell of dye filled the air. But it was watching a young girl, who was maybe 10, sewing a pair of jeans that made me feel sick. My host sister later told me that many of these workers, mostly women and children, were living on less than $2 a day. Suddenly, I looked at all the cute outfits I'd picked out for this trip in a completely different light. Before I'd seen the factory, I was so flattered when my new Bangladeshi friends had complimented my elegant name-brand button-down. They were proud that the tag on the shirt said made in Bangladesh. But after, all I wanted to do was wrap my traditional Bangladeshi shawl around me to cover the shame I felt. I'd been home from my trip for 3 months when I saw the horrifying headlines reporting more than 1,000 people dead from a factory collapse. I know this was not the same factory I visited, nor were these the same women or children I'd met, but I still felt close to them. I decided to do something. To raise money and spread awareness, I organized a fashion show that featured handmade clothes made by Bangladeshi craftspeople, as well as clothing manufactured in Bangladeshi sweatshops, the kind we're used to buying. People marveled at the clothes, but it wasn't until they saw the pictures of the workers that they began to feel what I had felt, empathy and guilt. Since I got back from Bangladesh, I haven't purchased any sweatshop clothes. Yet. I either thrift or suck it up and spend the extra $10 on an American-made t-shirt. But it's worth it. Though I will admit, it also feels better knowing companies like H&M are improving their factory policies. That way, if I'm tempted to buy something from Beyoncé's new summer line, maybe it will feel a little less like stealing. For Cross Currents, I'm Bianca Brooks.
That audio essay was produced by Youth Radio. And that's all for today's edition of Cross Currents. The team includes Julie Kane, Tiffany Kamhai, Lisa Carmack, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Dora Finkelstein, Chris Hoff, Alyssa Kapnick, Christina Loring, Liz Pfeffer, Mary Reese, Leah Rose, Stephen Short, and Eva Sonsin. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We visit an Oakland building where renters are holding on tight to their apartments.
But like your question, do you think you will stay here? Well, you never know, but as of now, the answer is yes. We have no other option.
The shrinking state of affordable housing. That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. This is Bay Area a cappella choir, the Pacific Mozart Ensemble. They don't limit themselves to Mozart, though, as you're hearing now. This music is by Rossini. The Pacific Mozart Ensemble will be performing their jazz and pop concert on Sunday at the Berkeley City Club. Concert starts at 5 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. Ba 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 ba